Welcome. You are hearing Auf Hebunga Bunga. This is episode 2, in which we discuss what you had for breakfast. Or Brexit. We don't know yet.
I suppose the point is that everything exists by virtue of everything else. By which I mean...
That's deep. No,
Okay, so I'm George Hoare. I'm on Twitter at POLWEQ. Still don't know how to pronounce that.
I'm Philip Cunliffe, and I'm at The Philippics on Twitter.
Okay, so what have you guys been, what's been preoccupying since we last spoke a whole 2 weeks ago? Some things have happened in the world, but maybe what's happening in your own heads feels more important and immediate to you. So, George, what have you...
Yeah, well, there are decades where nothing happens, and then fortnights where decades happen. Hasn't quite been one of those fortnights, but still a good line. Yeah, so I've been thinking. I read this article in Current Affairs on Hillary Clinton's failed campaign. I don't know if either of you saw it. If we were really professional, obviously we would have told each other what we were going to be talking about, so you could have read it. But no, I guess that. It just made me think that previously I thought Trump, he was the kind of the definitive politician, that entertainment and politics were exactly the same thing. But actually it's Hillary. She was the one who's way more representative of modern politics. Just that absolute obsession with, you know, algorithms and being smart in that West Wing way. So I don't know if either of you have read this article. It's very good. As Current Affairs actually, I think, is in general, that magazine. Have either of you read this? It's about.
I haven't read this. Fill this in, because the one that did the rounds as well was about the politics of the West Wing, and why that feels, so empty as a form of politics, but also why it has informed a whole generation about what politics is meant to be. Is that what you're talking about?
No. So that was Luke Savage's essay, which I thought was great. This one was Nathan Robinson kind of. Sort of a review of this book called Shattered, which is kind of an inside account of the Hillary campaign. And like all this like weird, ridiculous psychological stuff about her rating people on in terms of their loyalty, stuff like that. But what really came across was how Robbie Mook, who was the campaign manager, and I'm sure you guys knew this anyway, but the way in which the whole campaign was structured around like, oh, the algorithm says we don't need to campaign here. Or the algorithm says we don't need to do that. And all these kind of people saying, all these local organisers saying, well, actually, we need some money, we need some resources, just not being listened to at all. And I think the reason why it was a good article was to say, you know, this isn't the pathologies of one particularly weak, weird, actively dying candidate and a terrible campaign manager, but this is really what liberal politics of a certain centrist sort. Is it so hollow, and it's just this kind of shell of vote accumulation. So that's that. I mean, I enjoyed reading it. Also, kind of made me sad because Hillary, obviously, well, a Democrat candidate, really should have beaten Trump. It was there for the taking.
So this has been amusing me slightly, but also it's kind of interesting, right? So this was the headline in Court was Europe's youth don't care to vote, but they're ready to join a mass revolt. This is an EU-funded study, I think coordinated by the European Broadcasting Union. The selection of countries is maybe slightly odd, but I don't know why they've gone for that sample. But the sample's very significant, something like 580,000 respondents. And they're asked, would you join a large-scale uprising against the government? Now, the top four, which are all in the 60s%, maybe don't come as too much of a surprise. It's most of the pigs... three legs of the pig, I guess, and France. So that's Greece on 67%, Italy on 65%, Spain on 63%, and France on 61%. That, I guess, sort of stands to reason. I think the thing which really stood out for me was Luxembourg, on 45, which I'm guessing that's not the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, but possibly Rosa Luxembourg. I don't know. I haven't figured that one out. But I note that it's also funded by a Luxembourgish. Yeah, we'll go with that. Luxembourgish Film Fund, who perhaps have tipped the scales, put their finger on the scales to get that astounding result that 45% of young Luxembourgers want to overthrow their government. And perhaps hand direct rule to the banks, maybe. I don't know.
It doesn't say what they want to do instead.
But speaking of things which maybe we're a bit more familiar, it's the UK general election, which Theresa May has announced, hashtag GE2017, as they have it on Twitter. I think maybe it's worth giving an overview briefly on not only what's at stake, because I think that'll be a bit more of a substantive discussion, but what the lay of the land is in terms of the prospects for parties. Because the immediate reaction to this, was it not, that this is Theresa May's opportunism that to absolutely devastate the Labour Party and opponents to her right and institute a sort of Tory dictatorship in the UK. I mean, we read this pretty widely, right?
Yeah, I think
it was complaining from the left. I mean, it was complaining from disappointed Remainers who are shocked and horrified to see that politics involves power play and taking advantage of your opponent's weakness. Obviously, Theresa May can't be blamed for the fact that Labour made the wrong call on Brexit, that it devastated Labour's electoral polling fortunes as a result. And she can hardly be blamed for trying to take advantage of the political weakness of her opponent. I mean, it might not work out as she expects, both in the short and the long run. But the griping about its opportunistic character, I think, is a lot of it is self-serving, self-pitying, mewling from disappointed Remainers.
Well, firstly, well said, Phil. But I think the immediate reaction also showed maybe like two other things. One was just I don't know if either of you saw this, but there were some so-called political, and I use that phrase deliberately, so-called political journalists or commentators who went from basically saying, you know, if she calls because the announcement had been built up, if she calls a general election, then we won't be able to trust anything she says. Oh, she's called a general election. What political genius, what kind of strong leadership, what kind of like a stroke of like absolute just brilliance, which is, you know, that obviously just exposes, if it needed exposing, the absolute just terribleness of British political commentary. But I think also one thing which it did reveal, which was a lot sadder, which was related to what Phil was saying, is that there were so many people who are ostensibly left-wing who were like, no, we don't need more voting. This woman who was like, oh, not another election, that went viral and certain people were retweeting really, really enthusiastically. That was pretty sad, that basically people were objecting.
Do you mean
to
sad
voting,
like in a Trumpian sense?
I do. That is now what sad means. It's been displaced any previous meanings by now the Trumpian. I didn't use it at the end of the sentence though, so that is sad. But yeah,
form of punctuation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just very. I'm trying to think of a synonym for sad. It's very, very upsetting. But I don't like to use upsetting.
Right, and wasn't this there not a lot of voices calling for an immediate election as soon as Cameron and Osborne departed the building?
Really good point. No, not as many as there should have been. I remember having some discussions about this at various points, saying that the logical kind of the logical extension of the vote to leave should have been arguing for a general election in some form or other, because clearly there wasn't a clear vision of what Brexit meant, and so therefore probably just get party to articulate something and vote on it. Isn't that quite a simple answer to questions like this?
So I mean, this is the thing. For me, it seemed quite clear that whoever was prime minister. Okay, it's a parliamentary system. You don't directly vote for a prime minister. You vote for a constituency representative, which goes on to form a government if you have a majority. Nevertheless, it didn't seem that Theresa May and the cabinet she assembled had the legitimacy to carry through the Brexit negotiations without having held a general election. Do you agree? I mean, Phil, does that make sense, that there should have already have been an election a year ago, not now?
Yeah, I think it does. But I mean, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I think it does. Maybe I don't feel quite as strongly about it as George does. But I think there was a good argument to be made for a general election earlier. I mean, I think this echoes what George said. The hostility to the idea of popular participation in politics, bearing in mind also that there were so many complaints about the plebiscitarian character of the referendum, and then an equal volume of complaints about a general election, which is not an expression of direct democracy, but representative democracy, that it does give the suspicion to the observer that really what the hostility that's really being expressed is to mass participation in politics, full stop, and not to any particular form of that participation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was really disappointing to see the left kind of get outflanked by...
Disappointing, but unsurprising.
Yeah, absolutely. Unsurprising to see the left get kind of outflanked by these Tories who are actually just able to make a basic democratic argument. I also have another question, which is not really related to this. But Phil, like, are you sober, or at least way more sober than last time? Because you were saying things like, it does give the suspicion to the observer. I wrote that down when you said it. Whereas last time you were much more unequivocal in your mode of expression. So Alex, obviously you can cut this out.
I think he's maybe burning off of that insult that I called him authoritarian. So he's kind of couching everything with a lot of doubt.
He's sulking exactly right. for the whole episode.
I'm trying to. I am entirely sober, and I'm trying not to.
You shouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm entirely sober because you know, like, you want to be able to. If you want to be a dictator, you're going to have a clear head.
I'm not sure that's true.
I doubt history like upholds that notion. But anyway,
Hitler was a teetotaler, so Phil's got some good.
All right, I'll be
evidence.
Drunk next time then. Fine. Yeah, and I'm not a vegetarian, for the record.
It's kind of tempting to leave the elephant in the room, just kind of standing there, and talk about many other things, and then get on to Brexit. But I just think that's going to be absurd. As much as certain people have tried to claim that it isn't an election about Brexit, is there any way that one can claim that it isn't?
But I think it just tells you a lot about party politics in the UK. And maybe one of the major factors here is that Labour had nothing distinctive to say about Brexit beforehand, and maybe still doesn't. It's not really clear, at least to me, what their vision of what Brexit could look like. So therefore you get some kind of right-wing figures of the party detaching themselves and saying that it's, you know, you don't have to, this isn't a party issue. And I think that's a real loss or a real missed opportunity for Labour. And I think I might have even said this last time, kind of historically missed opportunity to articulate what progressive Brexit could mean. And that's, you know, that leaves the door open for such a
there's no way to ignore Brexit, right? I mean, but I think Labour in their 10 pledges, which reads to me pretty nice. You kind of agree with a lot of that. It's some sort of national developmental program, welfare spending, all the rest. You go, yeah, okay, that's kind of nice, I guess. It's nice, isn't it? I mean, that's people's attitude to Corbyn more generally. And yet it studiously avoids making any big declarations on Brexit.
Absolutely.
First of all, I don't think getting trapped in this progressive versus non-progressive Brexit is ridiculous. Brexit is progressive, full
Brexit
stop.
Brexit means Brexit. Oh, okay.
No, Brexit is progressive, full stop. Detachment from the European Union by virtue of being an expression of democratic popular will and restoring parliamentary sovereignty is progressive. Whatever the outcomes of the particular policy choices that future governments might make, the fact is that the democratic functioning of the British state has been, the potential for greater democracy has been restored. So it is progressive.
Okay, but we're well aware that there's plenty of domestic mechanisms, right? There's plenty of domestic mechanisms to be anti-democratic, to take things out of the hands of people, whether it's through more power for the executive at the expense of Parliament, in the House of Lords, through various quangos and other regulatory bodies, right? I mean,
I think that should be seen as part of the way in which the EU member state functions. So the point is that being embedded into EU structures means that you have this greater devolution of power is too kind of Quango style functioning. And also the kind of power that goes outwards and upwards to the European courts. So it's not simply that there is, it's not simply that the European Union is one among many ways in which democracy is whittled away, but also that it's the most significant way in which a whole host of technocratic measures were allowed to flourish and function in European countries.
Okay, yeah, as a question of historical process, that I think is undeniable. But that doesn't mean that the UK can't leave the EU while maintaining all the vestiges of those anti-democratic structures. George, isn't that right?
That wasn't what I was going to say at all, but I will.
I wasn't putting words into your mouth.
I'll answer your question by just saying what I was going to say anyway. No, I think this idea that Brexit is progressive full stop, the point that Phil made, is, I think that's really important, but is a point that was not articulated by any kind of sizable left-wing force in the UK. And I think that would have, yeah, if that's your starting point, which I think is the right starting point, then that is a way to kind of tackle or to start to link Brexit to some other potential changes, like, for example, House of Lords abolition or reform or whatever. But I think that was what was really missing. And that's why it seems like it's kind of free-floating above party politics at the moment, this issue of Brexit. And it hasn't really been anchored in what, you know, and I think that could have been a really successful Labour, obviously I'm kind of dreaming here, but a really successful Labour drive to say, you know, Brexit, this is something which is really significant, is really important, and is something that a process that we could own in a meaningful way. But yeah, that doesn't really answer your question. You can ask it again if you want, to me or to Phil.
No, but this is it. I mean, Phil's point is that the other domestic anti-democratic structures which exist have been created partly through the process of European integration. And what I'm asking is, if you withdraw from the EU, what prevents you from maintaining those anti-democratic structures?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's even making that link is something, and that was what was completely absent from the campaigns around Brexit, was actually, what is the EU? You know, we've talked about this previously, but not on this podcast. Is people are treated like fucking children. It was like, you do this, you vote like this, you get rewarded or you get punished. There was no real attempt to say, this is what the EU is. It's a, you know, there are all these anti-democratic aspects of it. And so therefore, there wasn't the foundation laid for the Labour Party or for any party to say, okay, this is what Brexit means and these are the reasons why it's progressive, rather than, and it's still essentially the same language, you have this consequence which is good for you or this consequence which is bad for you, rather than what the actual decision means.
Well, there are two things here, I guess. So I think while there are many ways in which popular will and democratic will can be channeled, contained and diverted, the basic function of Brexit is that government is plugged back into popular will. Now, that doesn't mean, that's no guarantee that any particular policy outcome will be the one that you might desire, but it restores the possibility for democratic politics. And that was the basic functioning of the European Union, was to unplug the way in which government functions from any kind of popular input, and rather to plug it into the integration with and negotiation with other governments around Europe. So on that very basic minimal point, it's fundamentally progressive. And it's important not to forget, because so much of Brexit sympathizing left are attached to the idea that what makes Brexit potentially a good thing is whether or not the welfare state can be revived, whether or not we can nationalize the railways or this kind of stuff, which is only to reconfirm their detachment from the most fundamental issues of democratic accountability and popular sovereignty.
Okay, but without a substantive idea of what sovereignty allows you to do, I mean, what's the point of it?
No, you're right. I mean, you're kind of baiting Phil here, right?
It's a very good point.
You're laying point.
out the trap for him.
No, it's a very good point. But I think
George, why don't you jump in? and then we'll get back to Phil.
Thanks. No, I think I mean we're kind of in danger of being our own little mini echo chamber here, because you know, shout out to the current moment Twitter and blog. I think they get it right. Consistently, but unfortunately, the only people who are really talking about this, you know, this starting point that sovereignty is, you know, it's not like, you know, sovereignty is good instrumentally. Isn't this kind of, I don't know, something that is the starting point of the left? That the what the left is historically is just the extension of popular sovereignty, and that is like, that is the most important thing. And this is a David Kaut book, 1966, which I remember reading and thinking, that's brilliant. And that's, you know, that's the starting point of politics. And if you don't start from that, then it's really dubious as to whether you're democratic or left wing in the first place.
I think the sovereignty topic hangs over not just this podcast, but the whole election. So I think
I don't think it does.
A little bit more specific. Then you can challenge that later on. So this is an interesting thing that's come out this week, and in fact it was yesterday that there was a whole Twitter thread translated from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung by Jeremy Cliff, about which was based on leaks from senior commission figures that May is basically a disaster and has, I mean, the headline from it is May believes her own PR on Brexit, and you, as much as you might justify her sort of public pronouncement saying Brexit will be a success, we just need to get all, we all need to get behind this and so on. If she actually believes it, that's maybe problematic. Just to give you an idea of what this.
Jeremy Cliff. No, it's this whole cast of political commentators who do nothing but suckle at the shriveled, disgusting teats of EU bureaucrats like Juncker, and that's the only place they can get their political insight from. Clearly, just this utterly cynical instrumental briefing by the European, by the EU Commission.
Phil, you're going to have to repeat that last little bit because it was completely breaking up.
So where did you, where did it stop?
Just continued from shriveled teat.
Shriveled, dry teat.
This account that Theresa May has basically no clue what's going on, that she is waltzing into these negotiations thinking they can be resolved very quickly and not taking into account all the complexities. There's a lot of self-serving stuff from Juncker and the EU here, but at the same time, that kind of substantiates certain ideas that we have about her.
Well, I think, you know, and I'm going to have a go at the chair of, or the host of this podcast, but I think that it's a too much of British politics gets talked about in terms of the, you know, the personality. So May versus Corbyn, Theresa May, is she competent? Is she strong and stable? What's her personality like? What does she wear? But actually, that's just fucking irrelevant. The underlying analysis, I mean, it's just a complete replacement of policy with personality. And this is not a particularly novel point, perhaps. But
no, it's not. Oh, thanks, Phil.
But no, but it's just like, it's what constantly gets replayed to us, that here are the psychological strengths and weaknesses of these various individuals, and they're played out in these kind of high pressure situations, such as campaigning, such as negotiating with the EU, and it's a real obfuscation of what the really important questions and issues are. Also, because these people, particularly the Conservative Party, they don't have any personality. They're just droids. So talking about personality politics is a real kind of, it's not an oxymoron, but it's really difficult to sustain in this context.
Right, but it has nothing. The thing is, this isn't just about a question of personality or psychology. What I'm drawing attention to is Theresa May's own lack of clarity and an underestimation of the power play that is involved in these negotiations.
No, but look, they were talking, the European Union is trying to intimidate the other side with this idea that everything is this incredibly drawn out, detailed, intricate, baroque process of bureaucratic negotiation that needs God knows how many experts and lawyers and bureaucrats and this official and that official, when they can cut, when there is actually the possibility to cut a political deal between political leaders. So the fact that she's a weak leader and the fact that the British state might not have the capacity in order to make up for the decisions and for implementing the kinds of decisions they're going to have to make as they decouple from the European Union is one fact. But the other fact is that I just simply don't believe that they can't simply politically agree. For instance, like Juncker was shocked by the idea that you could cut a deal on EU citizens' rights when it's the easiest thing in the world. They agree to treat each other citizens, British citizens in the European Union, EU citizens in Britain, with the, under the same reciprocal status that they enjoy at the moment, without too much difficulty. Sure. There is nothing about that that needs 10,000 pages of minutely specified insurance legal regulations drawn up in Brussels.
There's a general principle, I think, here of neoliberalism, that if something is presented as hard, so education or politics or EU negotiations, then it's actually quite easy. But if it's presented as easy, getting a job, being flexible, being mobile, then actually it's hard. And I think that actually kind of, you know, that might sound a bit trite, but actually it's kind of true. There's a definite complication and simplification. I know it's ironic that I use complication in that context. But it's like, I agree with you, Phil. It's just... It baffles me that some things are presented as so difficult when in fact there's an agreement and it should be a fairly swift process.
Technocracy legitimizing itself. They couldn't possibly make the process simple because that would be to totally undermine the justification for the European Union to begin with.
Yeah, I should have incorporated that into the thing that I just said because that's a good point.
Okay, but back then to the question of electoral contestation, because one way that one might have imagined this playing out was over competing visions of Brexit, whether it's seeking common market entry or not, about the role of migration and relative openness towards EU migrants and migrants from other parts of the world and so on. Has that been happening in Britain?
I mean, implicitly in the hard v soft Brexit and the very clear from the Liberal Democrats and to a lesser extent the Green Party that they're standing on the platform that they will offer a second referendum on the terms of Brexit negotiations. So, which obviously is a very explicit attempt to give the opportunity to renege on Brexit and to limit and contain and essentially subvert it. So there is effectively the Liberal Democrats are campaigning on an anti-democratic platform. So to that extent, I mean, there is a discussion about what Brexit should look like, but only in the crude sense of essentially recapitulating the leave and remain debate of yesteryear.
So I have a... and I want to see if the two of you think that this actually works. So basically the general election is a competition between the two main parties and the third party, and they each have a distinctive position. The Tories' distinctive position is basically that Corbyn is a shitbag and like don't vote for him. They call him all these antiquated terms and just basically say he's a socialist maniac. Labour are basically presenting 1997 nostalgia, and the Lib Dems are like, if you think that some mouth-breathing, shit-munching idiots voted for Brexit, we're going to give you a last kind of a last gasp attempt to try and overturn that. And I don't really see...
I mean, there's a certain integrity to the Lib Dems' position, isn't there? That they just are standing on a clearly anti-democratic platform, appealing to a certain segment of liberal, metropolitan, middle class, and they're just okay with that. And there's you got to certainly respect to that. There'll be a complete rump party as they continue to be, but I guess they'll pick up enough votes off of Labour's vacillation on the Brexit issue.
There must be some joke there about Tim Farron and not liking rumps or something. Phil, you've heard this, right?
Heard what?
That Tim Farron...
Phil's not been paying attention.
No, he's not. He's just.
He glazes over when the Lib Dems are mentioned, I mean, for good reason.
That's true.
He's just on Grindr, just whatever.
Fuck you, Tim Farron.
Yeah, when Tim Farron came up, I just turned on Grindr.
No, so Tim Farron saying that belatedly that homosexuality is not a sin, and then Nick Cohen saying, "Oh, you know, he might not like homosexuality, but at least he's not Corbyn." That was basically what I took from.
No, oh my God, that's totally unfair, George. Jesus.
Totally unfair, Nick Cohen.
You're going to make me defend Nick Cohen. Nick Cohen.
Let's hear it. No, Phil, defend Nick Cohen. Nick Cohen.
Checkmate. I'm playing like three-dimensional chess, where this is the winning move for you to defend Nick Cohen, and then I'm out of this podcast because that's.
It's clearly he didn't say that at all. Nick Cohen made the very basic case that. The point is, politically, Farron stands for a party that is unequivocally for defending equal rights for sexual minorities. That's what he's committed to electorally. And then his individual religious views about people's morality are neither here nor there. That's what Nick Cohen said, and which he's absolutely right. The constant hounding, if you wanted to take an example of the degeneracy and the low-life character of the liberal metropolitan British media. It was the hounding of Tim Farron over his personal views about homosexuality, which were neither here nor there.
I mean, I think there's some fairness to what Phil says. I think it might be an issue for those who are concerned about LGBT rights, for example. If the Lib Dems are your go-to party, then maybe... You might find their leader an unconvincing spokesperson.
There were many people saying, like, oh, this is going to affect the way this is going to traumatize sexual minorities. Gay teenagers aren't going to come out. This is what Owen Jones said, because there's so many.
Because of who the leader of the Lib Dems is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the level of ridiculousness on which it was. It was witch hunting, modern heresy. By a disoriented liberal media elite seeking some way to, I don't know, recuperate some moral high ground in the disorientation of the recent general election.
Okay. So I think we need to talk about Corbyn and the phenomenon, or otherwise, of momentum. Some people have argued that Corbyn's failure here indicates a failure of social democracy as a program, as welfareism. How much do we want to attribute blame to his actual politics versus other contingent aspects, maybe his weak leadership or the hostile media and so on? George?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. I guess the first point is to steal basically your idea, Alex. The best result of this election, I think, would be a victory for a really left-wing Labour platform. And the second best outcome would be the complete destruction of Labour. Is decimation electorally, so that something new had to come about. But the worst and most likely outcome is that you have a relatively narrow Labour defeat, or I can't say a relatively narrow Labour victory, but you know that's within that category. And I think that's that speaks to the kind of the heart of this question, which is the Labour Party as in its current institutional form fit for purpose, and the purpose being presenting an alternative vision of society and getting people sufficiently enthusiastic about it to vote for it. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what's going to happen. And I agree with you. It is undeniable that the weird thing is that it makes you sound insane when in polite company you say something like the mainstream media has a bias against Corbyn. People are like, oh no, that's terrible, or that's you're an idiot, because he clearly is a bad leader. He clearly does have the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, not behind him. So I think, and so Richard Seymour's book on the rise of Corbyn was I think really, really good, because he talks about all these factors which made it quite an unlikely rise, and then all these factors which could block Corbyn expressing what you might think is a kind of left social democratic policy platform, notably the structure of the Labour Party, the political establishment, All of these things that Gramsci talked about, shout out to Gramsci, in civil society, as this whole constellation of bourgeois power. You know, not to get too technical about it, but basically, it just seems so unlikely that a genuine socialist could win an election in the UK at the present time. So, particularly given that the Labour Party has, over the course of the last 20 years, you know, we've got 1997 nostalgia. Sorry, I'm talking for a long time here. We've got 1997 nostalgia at the moment, but in the last 20 years, the Labour Party has just kind of gradually receded, so that it's just a whole set of arguments which are completely contained geographically, culturally within Westminster.
Well, I mean, I'll come to Phil, because I think what we've got here is some people to the left of the Labour Party claiming that actually, if the Labour Party were able to express its programme and didn't face so much hostility, and I don't think we should deny the sheer degree of hostility Corbyn faces from a lot of the mainstream media, that it actually would have more success were it allowed to fully express its sort of left social democratic programme. What it has come out with so far could hardly be called left social democratic, I don't think, right?
The media is undeniably hostile to Corbyn. The media was totally, a significant section of the media was deeply suspicious and hostile to Brexit. It didn't stop the largest democratic mandate in British history mobilising behind Leave. So if there was sufficient democratic upsurge in favour of Corbyn, I think it would shatter through the media. The media has always been the excuse for the British left and its total incapacity to win over the electorate. And it looks like it'll probably be the excuse for the Corbyn left this time round as well. I think he's... I think the programme, which the 10 points which they've put forward, is very self-consciously populist in putting forward lots of kind of vacuous, empty notions that are intended to capture lots of free-floating opinion and is intended to be fashionable. And it's very clearly designed to be anti-establishment. The way in which it's positing the idea that there's this external establishment versus decent, commonsensical folk on one side and the establishment on the other, and it's crude left-wing populism.
That's of a piece with Labour's entire history, to be fair. So I don't think that we should be shocked at that, be against it.
No, but well, I am against it because I don't think it's an effective way. It's not an honest and genuine attempt to build a representative political movement or for a honest account of representative democratic politics. I don't think it is consistent with the Labour tradition. I mean, there's always kind of populist strains shot through on both right and left, but it used to be much more about defending working class interests, and that isn't so present. It is more anti-establishment idea, which is much more vague and amorphous than the idea of representing a particular class interest.
Right, but even so, even that being so, you might have a situation where, were it to be successful, because I don't think what you're saying denies that it can be successful. Were it to be successful, it might actually restart a new round of political contestation in the UK, which hasn't been seen for 25 years. So, and I think that's the fundamental wager that Corbyn for that matter, other left populist parties present in Europe.
It just seems to be cynical and opportunistic.
George, is it?
I think the analysis that you presented, I would really like to agree with it. I think if that were to be the aim of presenting this, you know, this policy platform to actually, I guess, get people engaged to the extent that you could then build a mass popular movement. Because don't forget that the Labour Party has grown in members massively recently, but it's still not a democratic institution. It's still, as a political party, is not geared to driving and catalysing and supporting the kind of political contestation I think all three of us would like to see. So, I mean, you're in a difficult position, I think. And, you know, Alex, obviously you're geographically excused from this, being in Sao Paulo, and just drop that in because we're Sao Paulo, London, Canterbury, you know, all the main political centres of the world.
We've got our finger on the pulse.
Thanks for rubbing it in.
So, yeah, absence of national parties. You know, this is something that Peter Mayer talks about in this Rule in the Void book that I probably should be on commission for sales of, the amount that I talk about it and recommend it. Because, yeah, I mean, there's not that, you know, political parties in the classic model, they're what catalyse social divisions, they're what allow a class to express its interests and then bring people behind that banner. And that clearly is such a long way from the intentions of the Labour Party. Well, I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it feels sometimes like it's such a long way from the intentions of the Labour Party that this idea that that Corbyn could institute a kind of a new contestation, a new political contestation in the UK, feels like really wishful thinking.
It seems to me it's cynical and opportunistic. I mean, this idea that we have to progress through these stages in which certain ideas where there's this... implicitly, you position yourself as this enlightened elite who have these sophisticated visions of what politics could look like, but the primitive masses out there couldn't possibly be exposed to these ideas, so we have to go through this long, drawn-out process of inculcating them with new ideas before they reach our advanced stage.
There's a problem of knowing too much versus knowing too little. There's a kind of feigned naivety in a lot of left populist programs because they're put together by intellectuals who have been around the block long enough, who would normally be putting forward perhaps programs which were much more Marxist in an explicit sense through small leftist parties who have no hope. And then there's a kind of popularization of their platform and a weakening of many of the claims. And so there's a kind of, they know too much, and they're pretending they know less. But at the same time, isn't defending Brexit similar in that regard, that you also have some vision of politics, Phil, but you're insisting on Brexit as a primary instance of repoliticization, which will then lead to further repoliticization? I mean, how is that not a populist program as well?
Because it's based on a recharging, a rejuvenation of representative politics independently of the outcome. So it's not counterposing some monolithic vision of the people, capital T, capital P, versus some sinister elite. That's not the vision of politics that I subscribe to. And I don't think it's the vision of politics that you would want to dissociate from Brexit. I think the point is Brexit has already re-energized British politics in the sense that you can see it in the after effects of the greater interest in politics stemming from the referendum, the sustained growth in membership of the major political parties, the interest in the general election. I mean, we'll have to obviously see what turnout is like, but I think it has already re-energized British politics simply by virtue of giving people a genuine, meaningful choice rather than a choice between two centrist parties.
That's fair enough. But I still think that anybody who's interested in rejuvenating politics and pursuing some form of left politics, however you want to characterize that, has some vision of some sort of stages vision of repoliticization, that you have some initial moment of repoliticization where you then radicalize your demands onwards from that. And I don't think there's a way to get away from that. I think we all have to accept that.
No, sure. I think, obviously things don't happen instantaneously, but that's all you're saying. I don't think that takes away from the need to argue for what you believe in terms of what you would like to see here and now, rather than limiting yourself to primitive programs and problematic parties and institutions as a way of believing that this is going to lead to some future distant promised land. And that's the path that the British left has consistently been following the Labour Party down for generations and generations. And where has it taken them?
George, you already said that trying to take control of the Labour Party, as anti-democratic as it is probably not a good bet for the future. But what about the policies then? Because, I mean, do these not have some popularity? We know that, for example, railway nationalisation is a bit of an open goal, and it's almost remarkable that it's taken this long for it to be pursued with any sort of enthusiasm. So there clearly is some support for a sort of social democratic program.
No, I think you make an important point here, which is that polls, as flawed as they are, tend to suggest that Corbyn's policies, broadly speaking, are popular. And even if his polling, personal polling, is not so popular. And that, you know, I think I have a lot of sympathy in some ways with what Phil's saying, that for the first time, and we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, for the first time actually thinking about British politics, and I'm kind of, you know, energised, a little bit nervous. So I was walking home from work, kind of thinking about this, about recording this podcast, and I was kind of excited. There's some interesting things happening. It doesn't necessarily mean that your side is going to win straight away, but finally you have a political event that has re-energized people, has got people arguing in ways that might threaten, you know, threaten niceties in various settings. And hopefully, you know, this is part of the process of saying, okay, well, railway nationalisation, what, you know, this is a real possibility. What do we actually think about it? Or what do people actually think about it? And it's, you know, it's popular. Anybody who uses a privatised railway company cannot possibly think that this, that it's working. It's, you know, it's terrible. It's fucking shit.
This is, we're going to have to kind of wrap up soon. And the point I wanted to get to, I guess, is assuming Labour is wiped out, and this is not a given, but the idea that they will be able to have a majority, I think, is fanciful. So given this, what is the what would be the message of this British election should May's Tories come out on top with a strengthened majority? One is, what does this mean for Labour's, even these kind of specific policies, whether it's railway nationalisation or stronger employment rights, repealing anti-union legislation, where does that leave that? And then I guess the other point is about Brexit. I mean, is that an endorsement of the Conservative specific vision of Brexit? Phil?
I don't think there is any specific vision of Brexit that it would be an endorsement of. They're simply beyond kind of vague platitudes, and they're simply kind of groping and fumbling along. So it'll be a mandate for the government to muddle through negotiations as best as they can. But I mean, there isn't any specific vision of Brexit that's being tested. Beyond that, I think it will be testimony to the real impasse of British politics, that it's been left to the right, traditionally so hostile and sceptical of mass politics and popular will, that they are the only ones who've been willing to express popular will and being willing to exercise a democratic mandate. And the ambivalence of the left and the Labour Party towards democratic politics has led to that situation that the Tories will have, by all accounts, I mean, if the polls are to be believed, and even if they're not quite, even if the first-past-the-post system ends up defending a kind of shell of a Labour Party, it still means that you have the fact that the right has managed to capture democracy effectively. And that's not, that's only testimony to the unwillingness of the left to unambiguously stand by democracy and popular will.
But I think Phil made an interesting point, which is how the right's captured democracy. And maybe this does link to the question that you asked. But I think too many on the left have, and maybe this resonates with what the two of you have experienced, maybe it doesn't, but have seen Brexit as something that needs to be explained, something that's wrong, something that's gone wrong, something that, you know, it's caused a lot of soul searching, it's caused some well-meaning, very earnest Guardian journalists to go to Brexit lands and talk to people and find out what, you know, what went wrong about this. But actually that's entirely the wrong position, because you've been outflanked, you've been caught out there if you see this as something that's wrong and something that is an aberration and something that is some kind of failure of people to grasp what they should have done. And so that makes kind of the policy consequences in some ways a little bit secondary, because unless the left really gets behind, you know, this expression of, you know, and I think we have to defend it in these quite animated terms, that this expression of popular sovereignty, unless the left gets behind that and owns it and extends it, then it's going to be kind of in a really difficult, on the terrain of struggle, it's going to be in a really difficult position, and it's going to be beaten by some political pygmies of the current Conservative Party, which is just such a fucking shame. There you go. Anyway, what's your point? What's the alternative?
On that cheery note, I think we should probably wrap up. We'll definitely have a lot more to say about the British general election in the month to come, and a lot more, including a discussion about why everyone loves the Kurds next week. So please join us then. This has been Alpha Bunga Bunga. See you later.